Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we have a fun panel of writers who are featured in the anthology Dear McSweeney's, 2 decades of letters to the editor from writers, readers, and the occasional bewildered consumer. This program is hosted by McSweeney's senior editor, Daniel Levin Becker. It originally took place September 21st, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Tonight, we're going to talk about letters, writers, readers, moths, mummies, macaroons, cats and armadillos, and homicidal sea worms as we delve into more than 20 years of letters from McSweeney's Quarterly Concern. Dear McSweeney's dives into the archives of the legendary magazine to discover what people say back to a publication that has so much to say to them. The book is edited by Daniel Levin Becker, senior editor at McSweeney's. He's the author of Many Subtle Channels and What's Good and translator of numerous works. He joins us tonight with an assembly of contributors to the anthology. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you so much, Allison. I'm going to apologize in advance. Due to a clerical error, we're actually all going to be talking about homicidal sea worms tonight.
Excellent. So
any of you who are faint of heart, please log off now. So thank you all for joining us today to celebrate the official pub date of Dear McSweeney's, which I'm happy to report is maybe the most self-explanatory book project I've ever been involved with. It, as its subtitle says, it's 2 decades of letters to the editor from writers, readers, and the occasional bewildered consumer. The letters were for the most part published in Timothy McSweeney's Quarterly Concern, which is the roughly quarterly, mostly fiction journal that McSweeney's has been publishing since 1998. There are a handful of pieces that are also that were published online in the listserv kind of thing that floated around the scene toward the end of the 90s and in the beginning of the aughts. And as Allison said, it really runs the gamut in terms of theme, in terms of author, in terms of length and approach. There are a lot of pieces that read like postcards from exotic destinations. There are a lot that read like postcards from the most mundane possible domestic scenarios, in which the authors just managed to wring some really fascinating slices of life from their everyday experiences. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to some of our contributors to whom I'm very grateful for helping us celebrate this launch. And first I will ask Brian T. Edwards to read his letter.
Thanks, Daniel. I'm so happy to be here. Mine is one of those exotic letters, I suppose, written from Cairo, although I'm reading to you from New Orleans, where we're still getting over the power and internet grid. So I hope I don't cut out on you. I wrote this letter to McSweeney's actually while I was in Cairo, working on a special portfolio of Cairene writers for a public space, which was coming out around the time. And I stopped to write this letter. It was during Ramadan. Dear McSweeney's, I've never tried to explain why I keep coming back here. It could be that in some ways I don't grasp it myself. I just get on the plane again and off the plane again, and then I'm here. I didn't plan this trip. It was an impulse. I had work to do, but that wasn't it. It hit me that it was Ramadan, and I've never been here during Ramadan. Something unexpected always happens. It might come a hair closer. The answer to one more of my questions about Cairo might reveal itself when I at least expect it to. But also, after all the messiness of the past year, it was something of a gift to myself. Every Ramadan I spent in Morocco felt somehow cleansing. I actually like fasting, the strictness of nothing passed between your lips, not food, not water, not a cigarette, not even gum or a toothbrush or a kiss, the intensity of it. The night I arrived, I got to the hotel just before 1 a.m. I keep a cell phone for Egypt with an Egyptian SIM card and my Cairo phone number in it, and it runs out of batteries between trips. It uses a Euro plug, 2 prongs, and the network doesn't work in Chicago, so I can't check it when I'm away from here. But when I turned it on, it's like magic. It reconnects me to this world in a way that Facebook never can. By 2 a.m., I was out with a friend. We ended up at his place talking and drinking the last of the scotch that his British girlfriend had brought him. And then it was almost 4 a.m. and I was teasing him about something when the call to prayer started. I had no idea dawn would come so early. It was still pitch dark outside. It turns out that they moved up daylight savings time by about 6 weeks to make Ramadan work a bit better for everyone. And his girlfriend says, "You better hurry." So he runs to the refrigerator to gulp down half a liter of water before he can't drink for the rest of the day. When he rejoins us, he says, "The call to prayer is like a pyramid, and I caught it before the peak, so it's okay." Sunset these days is at 6:30 p.m. and it's 97 degrees out when the sun's out. Outside when the sun's out, so drinking that water will come in handy. But even so, he sleeps most of the day. No job. Well, he's a writer. The days have a special rhythm here in Ramadan. People stay up so late, maybe because of the abundant iftar meals at sunset that stretch out like a month of Thanksgivings. Sometimes there's a lighter meal before dawn, suhoor, and then you snooze away the daylight till it starts up again. You're wondering how people with regular jobs can do this. But I have another friend here who works in an office, and he met us downtown for suhoor tonight on this boat on the Nile. There was tamia, falafel, and tamarind juice, and live music, and the call to prayer started just as we climbed into taxis. I've fasted before, but this time I have too much work to do to struggle through the day without some nourishment, so I modified the law. I'm doing a coffee fast. No food, no water, just coffee when the sun is up. To be honest, it's not so hard. I can't eat for the first few hours after I wake anyway, and then you're almost there, so why not push all the way through? And it's putting me into this state where just as I get to that time of day when my writing comes best, I'm half hallucinating from the caffeine and the dehydration, and it's something between automatic writing and writing drunk. I love it. And when I go out rushing to meet whomever for iftar, I'm eager and wired, and that first taste of food is so perfect. You really should fast if ever you get a chance. It's 5 a.m. now and the sun is coming up. I'm not sure if it's just easier to stay on Chicago time, since going to bed at dawn here is like going to bed when you'd go to bed there. Night here starts when an imam somewhere in the Saudi desert can't distinguish between a black thread and a white thread. Morning begins when the first thread of sunlight scratches the eastern sky. Those are the hinges upon which Ramadan turns. But I have to tell you about something I saw yesterday that I hadn't noticed before. I was passing under this bridge that crosses over the Nile and then lets out in Zamalek, where I'm staying. There were rows of empty tables beneath it. I had made my way between them earlier in the day without thinking about it. But when I came back at about 6, they were filled with people sitting quietly, waiting. Someone told me they're called Ma'idat al-Rahman, tables of mercy. They're for poor people who can't afford to cook a big iftar, or for people who can't get back to their houses in time to break the fast. And they're paid for by rich people or mosques or neighborhood associations. Zamalek is a wealthy neighborhood by Cairo standards. And I don't know if that's why, but the food they brought out looked good, meat and soup and baby zucchini stuffed with more meat and green peppers. And so I waited there just watching without seeming to watch, while the people waited for the call to prayer to permit them to start. One man, dark like a Nubian from the south, had his head down on the table, maybe tired, maybe dehydrated. There was a hush of anticipation, a sense of community, of shared purpose. I'm not a religious person, but at moments like that, I miss a connection to something bigger, to something infinite. Cairo has 16 million people living in it. At times when you walk up the busiest thoroughfares, you can feel like a speck, just a granule of dirt in the city where pollution smothers the sky and smears the walls right down to the pavement. It could be I want to be forgotten, to disappear into the 16 million Cairenes making their way through a city that will forget them, never knew them, breathes them with filthy lungs coated with centuries of grime and anonymity. But then at those tables of mercy, there was a moment. It took me aback, of peace and silence and anticipation. It happens each day after depriving yourself, and I was depriving myself too in my way. I was coffee fasting. That brief and gorgeous moment of cool water coming down your throat and into your belly. You have passed another day of glory on this earth and in this city that has been here since the time of Khufu. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for that beautiful letter. What year was that from? I know it was from
I should have said that was from 2010. He published it in McSweeney's 34. Here's the original special issue kind of packaged in with plastic, along with the book about the then still relatively new war and an occupation of Iraq. So it was before, about a year before the so-called Arab Spring and Tahrir uprisings. And I was spending a lot of time with some of the writers, the Cairo writers, writing and kind of breaking apart the novel in Arabic, I would say, doing amazingly interesting work in comics and so on, and stopped to write that letter to you all.
And were any of them, were you or any of them already affiliated with McSweeney's, or what inspired you to send this letter to us?
I had been writing some pieces for The Believer at that point. And so I hadn't been writing for McSweeney's, but I think it was sort of the same address.
Wonderful. You did a really wonderful job subtly interweaving the homicidal sea worms into the piece. Thank you. So now I will pass the mic, such as it is, to Mark O'Kay.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Brian. That was a beautiful piece. It was a great evocative postcard for sure. This one is more, if I'm a sea worm, a homicidal sea worm, it's more of a suicide mission that I did upon myself, where I really messed up at trying to get my first freelance job. I work as a advertising creative. This is my kind of big break for real. And I really botched it by not filling out a questionnaire right. And this letter has a lot to do with internet pop-ups, which haven't all been eradicated, but were even more of a nuisance back in 2011 when this letter ran in the quarterly. Dear McSweeney's, here's what I want to know. When you don't realize that a crime you committed was a real type of crime, and so you fail to tell a prospective employer about it, is that tantamount to covering it up? I didn't think so, but this human resources company seems to. When I told their guy Reed that maybe it was a you had to be there kind of thing, but I bet you wouldn't have realized it was a misdemeanor either. The voice at the other end of the line was far from sympathetic and not nearly as musical as the name I made up for him might suggest. Trespassing, as I have come to understand, is something that will show up on a background check. Legally, I am not at liberty to say where I applied for this job, but I'll divulge that the company is involved in searching the internet. Given that the place was founded on background checking everything in the entire world, it was probably a little foolish of me not to make a mental sweep of the dusty corners of my life before I sat down for the interview. And of course, the I-9 application I filled out a few days later wasn't designed to help me remember my criminal record, but wouldn't it have been nice if it had been? Have you ever been convicted of a misdemeanor or felony? Caught red-handed in an unlucky moment of public urination? No judgments here, we've all done it from time to time. Or maybe you and your friends were looking for a secret swimming hole 5 years ago, and the only path just so happened to cut through some property owned by the Girl Scouts. Think really hard before checking yes or no. Think, Marco. An impractical vision, sure. But consider, to use the internet developer's term, the basic usability of these employment forms. Reed said I had to complete them on a PC. And since my parents lived too far away for me to use theirs, I went to my public library. Once there, so many pop-up windows interrupted my experience that I may as well have been filling the thing out while driving and texting. After each page loaded, I received a warning. This page contains both secure and non-secure items. Do you want to display the non-secure items? The first 15 times I selected no. Then I thought, what if the non-secure items are really important? So I clicked yes the next 35 times. Unlike with the law, there seemed to be no right answer. More boxes demanded my attention, pop-ups within pop-ups. As I finished each page, I was asked to electronically sign it. This brought up another box. To the best of your knowledge, is the information contained herein true and correct? Once, with this box, I accidentally clicked no, confusing it with the non-secure items box. Luckily, the startled grunt I let out didn't disturb any of the library's other patrons, and I was able to change my answer. But can I really blame my carelessness on pop-up windows alone? A good deal of culpability rests on the soft shoulders of a woman whom I'll call Trixie. Trixie with her long legs, interestingly dyed hair, and mild acne. Unlike Reed, her fake name is telling. She was our travel agent to this secret brook, talking up its amenities, describing her own photos from an imaginary brochure. On our hike to the spot, we passed two girls hightailing it back down to the banks of a sunny river wherein scores of law-abiding citizens floated, contented people who didn't want any more secrets in their lives. Mum's the word, one of the retreating girls said, but I wouldn't go up there. Trixie pressed her for more information, but we all knew what was waiting ahead. For a moment, we stood at that spot, what I now think of as my line of liability. And somehow Trixie convinced everyone that the girls were lying. They were trying to protect the secret swimming location, using an antiquated British idiom to throw us off. Though she'd forgotten their names, Trixie admitted that she'd had an altercation with one of them in the past. The police couldn't possibly be hiding out up there, she insisted. Only 60 feet around the bend. Seems to me that the dumbest sins are the ones you have to atone for again and again. Lesson learned. Yours truly, Marco K.
Thank you, Marco, for that sobering cautionary tale.
A pop of windows and trespassing on Girl Scouts property while trying to get a job at a search engine.
That will continue to remain nameless.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Marco. And now I'll pass things to Ingrida Martinkus to read her letter.
Hi, I was just taking myself off mute. I wrote this letter to McSweeney's back in 2001, March, and it was just an ordinary cold Chicago end of winter day. And I was exhausted, hassled, and trying to get home. And I was hoping for a very disengaged, uninteresting cab ride home with a cab driver that wasn't trying to make perfunctory small talk or trying to peddle me some kind of products or anything that would change my life. And instead, I got Bill. Dear McSweeney's, one evening while sitting quietly in the back seat of a taxi, I noticed the driver holding a piece of paper. It looked like a business card. It was a business card. The card dangled between his thumb and index finger as he held it over his shoulder, elbow braced against the passenger headrest. I watched the card for several minutes, swaying to and fro with each pothole hit, traffic light stop, corner turn. Then he stretched his arm through the plexi window opening and said, "Here," flicking the card towards me, gesturing for me to take it. I took it. It was creamy in color, a bit textured, grainy to the touch. Blank. I turned it around. Written in plain Arial 12-point font was Bill, cab driver. His arm still stretched through the window opening, hand empty, fingers wiggling. He asked, "Could I have the card back?" I gave it back and said, "Thank you." He half turned and smiled a toothy smile. That was a little observation, a moment of everyday joy. And I think the thing that I liked most about it was it was just like a human connection when I least expected it. So, yeah.
Even then, a testament to the importance of print.
Exactly. Arial font, you know, you wouldn't think.
It gets a bad rap.
It's a horrible, horrible rap.
So this was one of the pieces in the book that came from the internet. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to post that to what I assume was a listserv? This was before my day.
Oh, yes. So since this was in the early aughts, I already was a fan of McSweeney's. The Quarterly Concern was coming out. And I had known on McSweeney's website that there was a call for, you know, any observations that you might see, you know, funny events that take place or comments or concerns that you want to share, just send it our way. So what I appreciated about that was that McSweeney's kind of was collecting different people's everyday life stories, you know, little smatterings here and there. And that kind of collection that was happening to all these people at different, you know, locations throughout the world, it was just this kind of wonderful community of letters being written in. And it was kind of also a very interesting take on your typical letter to the editor, which normally are very kind of like straight and formal and little highbrow or whatnot. But this was kind of, this was a much more personal take on a letter to an editor.
Great. I will say this is a little behind the scenes editor talk that obviously most of my work in compiling this anthology was going through the print issues of the Quarterly and reading the letters and selecting which ones I wanted to include. And then at one point I stumbled upon this huge trove of internet letters. And I was like, oh man, I got to go through these now. There are really tons of them. They're cataloged by month. They're all available online. And I started to read them and I was like, oh man, I'm never going to finish reading them. So I started to skim them and it was a little bit of a slog, but every now and then there was one that would stick out and I would be like, I have to include this. And this was absolutely one of them. It's just such a perfect little snow globe of a human moment. So thank you. Thanks for being willing to let us include it.
Oh yeah. Thanks.
All right. I'm going to pass it to Ben Cohn.
All right. Thank you very much. I really enjoy this. And thanks for including I have two letters in this and I'm going to read one of them. They were two in for me, they're dispatches from a neighborhood. I'm calling right now from Easton, Pennsylvania, which is in Eastern Pennsylvania. Although I lived in Virginia for a long time before we moved here about 10 years ago. This is from issue 35, also, so 2010. Same year as Brian's. We lived in an odd to us neighborhood outside Charlottesville. And I had moved there from Blacksburg, where I had the fortune to be friends with the internet tendencies editor, John Warner. And so I spent time in the first decade working on the website and working on lists and contributing online. And then when I moved, I think I had the chance to just document some of these things and send them on to the journal, to the magazine Quarterly itself. So this is the first of two. I'll just read the one for us. Dear McSweeney's, the guy across the street is an insurance salesman. He cornered me on my driveway once soon after we moved in and asked if I had term or life. He's an affable, if fearful, person. His six-year-old son was at our house one time and explained that we should never go to New York. Why is that, Jay? Because you'd get robbed, he said. But why is that? Because they ban guns. You can't bring your gun. And that, for me, was a cinematic moment. A lens telescoped out my window across the street, through their brick walls, into the dinner time kitchen to see the conversations between father and son. I didn't begrudge the kid, since I could see where he got it from. Fear must have some basis. That was after his father, the insurance salesman, firmly and without prompting, advised me not to swerve my car to avoid squirrels or groundhogs or whatever, especially if the family's with me. He barrels down on them. There's no way you prioritize that squirrel over your family's health. I took note. I should also park my car facing out, as he does. He's always got the car facing the street for an efficient getaway, should it be necessary. When I'm reading on the front porch of my house and he comes home, I see the car pass his driveway, gently brake, and then slowly back in. I haven't talked much to my neighbors on the other side and up a few houses, but I know her husband is being treated for prostate cancer. He waves from his tool stock garage sometimes when I drive by. The neighbor behind us, the one with the trampoline, has been dying of brain cancer for 2 years. When her husband is walking their dog and I come home to find him at the end of my drive, dog on leash 2 feet from him, a steaming pile of dog shit 2 feet farther, and he says, "Oh, that's somebody else's. That's not mine." I can only shrug and say, "Hi, Billy," because what do you do? What do you say? A girl from the bus stop wasn't at the bus stop for a few days before we all learned that her appendix had burst. The doctors didn't catch this upon her first hospital visit, and she'd come back late that night, sallow, pale, limp, and pretty damn close to death's door. She was in intensive care for weeks, her internal organs undermined. All reports were that they didn't expect her to make it. They used those words. They didn't expect her to make it. She made it. And when I hear her grandfather ranting at the bus stop about liberals and his guns and who's out to get him, I don't engage. Her mother committed suicide after she was born. Her grandparents take care of her. I don't know why he's so hate-filled, but I know there's more going on than I see. The latest self-improvement efforts by my wife and I are about trying to understand other people better. That, we suspect, will make us less frustrated. Then maybe we can be better people. We've tried a number of things, not too successfully, so this is our newest plan. Our kids are growing up. Soon, both of them will be in school all day long somehow, and Jesus, I don't know how that happens. I'm not good at dealing with time's passage. I'm a historian who's no good at dealing with time's passage in my own life. I don't want my children to have to justify their own fears and anxieties or point to us. I don't want them to have any, but they'll get them from us, and someone else will, if lucky or will not, more likely, wonder where they came from. We can't avoid it unless this self-improvement kicks in soon. So there's that. I was writing because when I got home last week, I saw a new car parked in the driveway across the street. It was, as is customary, parked facing the road in getaway position. I walked in the house, my wife standing in the living room, sorting through the mail, the sun angling in across the floor. I see they got a new car over there. Insurance sales must be booming, I say. She looked at me, and she looked out the window, and she looked back at me and smirked subtly. "No," she said, only barely revealing her smile, but enough so I knew that she'd come to understand some essential truth. "That's his parents' car. They're visiting. I'll be in touch again soon. Thank you."
Thank you, Ben. And you were indeed in touch again soon, because you have another letter, which is kind of a sequel from quarterly issue 39, which maybe you can just recap for us a little bit.
Yeah, so that was, I think I wrote that one as we were moving from Virginia to Pennsylvania, and it was somewhat of an update on, the people who had passed away, like our neighbor from that died from brain cancer. And I think in the letter I made a reference, I finally realized that we had another neighbor who I'd never seen for like 5 years. Like, they lived literally 100 feet away, catty corner, and we just never seen them. And I think I have a reference in there to, at the time, people were all shocked in Abbottabad, like when they got Bin Laden, that people didn't know he was there. And how could this be? I was like, I kind of get it. Like, I didn't know who this guy was in my sight line for like 5 years. I'd never actually seen him. So it was expanding. If I recall this, it was expanding my sense of what the neighborhood was and what it meant to be leaving it, what it meant to be leaving that house, and what it's not like I intended it to be all about death, but there was a lot of pain and illness all around that house, and hoping that we would also perhaps be escaping that as we moved out of the neighborhood.
So thank you again. This was so we've heard a number of really lovely kind of human moments of intimacy at different levels of zoom out, in Marco's case, perhaps too intimate. And that's really, compiling the book, that was one of the most inspiring and heartwarming things, was just the way these letters function as this kind of unsolicited, or sometimes solicited, but unexpected missives that just sort of fill the reader in on these wonderful little moments that are happening all around the world. But because it is a McSweeney's joint, and it wouldn't be a McSweeney's joint without some kind of madcap gonzo humor, I'm going to read a letter from Steve Delahoyd, who I believe is in the audience tonight, but decided not to read. And this is a quick letter of his from issue 36. Dear McSweeney's, one of the most recognizable lines from Superman in all its various forms is that guy yelling, "Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman." But in the moment before it's made clear that Superman is flying by, doesn't the line imply that the guy's just some weirdo screaming at people to look up at birds and planes all day? Sincerely, Steve Delahoyd. And because we've got some time left, I'm going to read the first letter from the book, which is from Deb Olin Unferth. And it's from issue 57, which was the McSweeney's 20th anniversary issue. And so among other things, it came, as you probably know, the quarterly is redesigned with every issue. So sometimes it'll look like a book, sometimes it'll look like a magazine, sometimes it'll look like a pile of junk mail, sometimes it'll be a newspaper, sometimes it'll be a cigar box with a comb in it. And it's often bundled with these very small one-off productions. And so issue 57 came with a little bound volume of letters from McSweeney's people and from writers wishing us a happy 20th birthday and reflecting on their own decade in their 20s. So this is Deb's. Dear McSweeney's, welcome to your 20s. I passed mine much the way you have been so far, carried the same kind of broken furniture up and down flights of stairs, had the same assortment of roommates, the same old appliances that can't be cleaned, though like you, I cleaned the hell out of them. I had similar half solutions and about 100 jobs. I groped. It is the decade for that. High school is over. College, for those who go, ends. There's no further official sanctioned path for you. You are spit out of the system, tasked with supporting yourself. Good luck. And must endure all the tautological admonishments to be yourself. For the first time, you are utterly undetermined. Here's a story. One night, at the beginning of my 20s, I was walking to my apartment from the train and came upon a strange structure, a giant apparatus of pulleys and ladders and wire. It had somehow unraveled in front of my building. It stretched for half a block, rose 2 stories high, and was lit up like a vast construction site. As I moved closer, I could see people crawling around on it. They were up on a scaffolding. They were turning large wheels. Not construction workers. Angels in white robes with feathery wings and large eyes, some of their faces so white they seemed chalked, others very dark. It was not a vision, McSweeney's. It was an art installation. Someone had come along and put it there to confuse us. I noticed a herd of people lined up beside it. The head angel was collecting forms people had filled out. She was taking the slips of paper and attaching them one by one to a wire. The forms then rode through the maze on the wire, around corners, up to the top, where the final angel stood on a precarious platform, her robes and wings very pale against the dark. She tied each slip of paper to a balloon. Then she lifted to her toes and let the balloon drift into the sky. The sound of peaceful strumming, a soft wind. The people around me were gazing up. We were dull, rumpled, washed out as a newspaper. We watched the slips of paper disappear into the night. We were all wondering the same thing. Could it be so easy to float away what we don't want? I hurried to the table and took a form. I scrawled a shape on it that only I and whoever could see into my mind could understand, but it contained all I needed it to. I was the last one in that long, long line. The line was so long that by the time I reached the front, it was midnight, and the angels in the sky were stepping down off their suspended chairs. They were leaving. I reached out my trembling hand to the head angel, but she said, "You're too late," in a nasal voice, in English, though a moment before she'd spoken only angel language. Too late? The strumming stopped, and all I could hear was a cold, harsh, howling wind. I'll tell you what I did, McSweeney's. I shoved my form into her hand anyway. I thought she might throw it back at me in a wadded ball and take off running, but she didn't. She groused a little, stomped off, and got a balloon, tied it, and let it go, making a mean face at me as she did. It didn't go gently, McSweeney's. It careened haphazardly and too fast. I thought it might get stuck in a tree, but it continued upward, that paper left this earth. But I hadn't seen the last of it, as I believed. I thought we were floating those papers up into the sky to get rid of what was on them, but I was wrong. We were sending out pieces of ourselves, like an advanced team, into the universe. Here I am. 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 I know this because the scrawl pulled me up with it. I felt my feet slowly lifting and following. It pulled me through 22, 23, 30, like a rope dropped into the fire, raising me out of the volcano and on into the future. That scrawl turned out to be my strength, not my weakness. Here you are, McSweeney's scrawl and all. It's you. Vibrant, startling, light-filled. Headed toward the sky. Lifted by angels and air. You, advancing. Love, Deb Olin Unferth, Austin, Texas. Allison, shall we take some questions?
I did have one question while we're waiting for folks to do this. When you were selecting these pieces, Daniel, what were some of the criteria? What were you looking for when you were choosing them?
It's a great question. I didn't really know what I was looking for when I started looking. I was very much a fan of the principle that in a lot of searches, you don't know what you're looking for until you stumble upon it. There were a few criteria that I came by eventually. For instance, there's some letters that I really love, but that weren't addressed to McSweeney's, that were published in McSweeney's, but were addressed to somebody else, like Davy Rothbart, the guy who founded Found Magazine, wrote a letter to his little brother, I think, about what to do in the event of it, like how to distribute his possessions in the event of his death. And that's a really beautiful letter. Susan Strait also wrote a letter to one of her kids about sort of growing up in a racist world. And they're really wonderful, touching letters, but they didn't quite fit the criteria of, I don't think this was even before we knew that the book was going to be called Dear McSweeney's, but they didn't say Dear McSweeney's, and so they weren't ultimately eligible. Because I think there's a really interesting way that I haven't theorized in a particularly interesting fashion, but that when you read all these books and these letters keep being to McSweeney's, they keep being addressed to this publication, but they're also addressed to you. You get to read them. You get to listen in on these dispatches, these moments of human interaction and intimacy and strangeness. And I think that's something really special. And it sort of would have broken the spell to have to keep in your mind a third or a fourth addressee interlocutor. Otherwise, there weren't really very many criteria. I pretty quickly decided that I wasn't going to organize the book by any explicit organizing principles. So they're not in chronological order. They're not thematically grouped. It's just sort of, I approached it basically the way I would approach a mixtape, which is to say you start with something strong and then, you know, as Nick Hornby says in High Fidelity, you have to up the ante right after that. And then you can kind of find a rhythm, but you have to keep changing it up every now and then. And so, in a very completely subjective way, I just sort of would read each letter, figure out what I wanted to go next, sort of let that wash over me, and then look among the almost probably the slightly more than 100 that I'd earmarked for inclusion and say which seems like it's going to respond best after that. I think that's it. I might be forgetting some important but mundane.
Daniel, can I ask you a follow-up?
Yeah.
I want to ask you a follow-up question to that. Since did you see, even though you didn't organize the book chronologically, did you feel over time reading through them all that the letters were changing in some way? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that question is that, like, one of the most amazing things about, well, actually, answer the question, then I'll tell you. I have some theorizing about this, but I'm curious what you saw, because you're one of the few people who's read them all, probably.
Yeah. So one thing that's really interesting is it's sort of actually easy to divide them into two segments, because there's a whole series of issues of the Quarterly in the 20s that don't have letters. So there's sort of the first 15 to 18 issues had letters very consistently. And then sometime in the 30s, the letters picked up again. And it's a little bit facile, probably, to generalize, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think in the first set of these, McSweeney's was certainly much much more engaged in the process of figuring out what it was. It was a lot of the people. It was a lot of Dave Eggers and his friends and people who were sort of already in on the in crowd, figuring out what the publication was going to be, what it meant to write a letter to the editor. There are a lot of letters from pseudonyms in those early issues, which was kind of a headache to track some of the people down. There's a guy named Gary Pike, who turns out not to exist, whose letters are consequently not in the book, but I urge you to go back and find them in the first. He pops up here and there in the first 10 issues or so. I think of those as really experimenting with the form of a letter to the editor in a really compelling way. And then after the hiatus of the letters, they read to me much more like postcards from people who are already writers. They already have careers and their careers are taking them places. They're on a book tour, or they're about to launch their new book, or they're doing some work that already has sort of placed them in this orbit. And the dispatches are a little more, I don't want to say professionalized, but a little more streamlined in terms of the message they send. There's a little less what I read as existential wondering about what am I doing by writing this letter. Now let's hear your theory.
No. It's interesting. I mean, the first part, like McSweeney's, you know, I was thinking when Ingrid was talking from 2001, you know, was changing so much about the way people wrote and read for that, mm-hmm. for a generation, that there was, you know, that kind of, you called it the addressee, like you're writing to McSweeney's. And actually, by the way, you asked me what caused me to write the letter. I totally forgot the whole history of it. I actually was asked to write for the newspaper issue, that letter, and it got bumped to the next issues, but so it was actually solicited. I can't remember if it was solicited as a letter or as a travel piece that was then rewritten as a letter. But anyway, but you know, that there was, it was changing McSweeney's every issue, whether you knew the writer or you didn't know the writer, was changing the way a lot of people were writing and thinking about writing. And so the letters became this place to try that out and to, you know, kind of have this, you know, you were writing to everybody who was reading McSweeney's as well, mm-hmm. as McSweeney's. So make what you just said totally confirms that those first ones were very experimental. But then later, after the gap, you know, it was interesting that so many of us wrote right after, in the mid-30s, mm-hmm. You know, became a more literary space, obviously. But it was also like you knew you weren't writing. I mean, if you write Dear McSweeney's, you weren't just writing an essay or an observation or a piece of fiction. You were writing to, you know, the people who read McSweeney's. And just like you said, you know, there's a certain range of stuff people were doing there that was either madcap or literary or whatever. So it's a really fun thing to write, you know, because you felt who your readers were going to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a unifying thread in that all of these letters are pieces it would be pretty hard to publish as anything else. You know, although you said, you know, maybe yours was commissioned as a travelogue. Every now and then there's some pieces that would work as a straightforward travelogue or as a straightforward essay. Some of the, or just as, you know, a lot of them read sort of like they could be just whacked out Facebook rants. Like I think Jonathan Lethem from the first, second or third issue writes a letter that's just exclusively about Jerry Lewis's film career. There's no introduction. There's no intro, no outro. It's not like, hey, Dear McSweeney's, I've been thinking about this, or something in your last issue made me think about Jerry Lewis. It's just Dear McSweeney's, bunch of information, sincerely, Jonathan Lethem. But I think you're totally right that after this period of kind of existential searching, in a way, I want to say the letter section was a victim of its own success, except I mean that without any negative connotation, that like the success of the searching was this thing that became almost a known quantity, but a known quantity that people knew was a place they could experiment with this kind of writing.
Thank you so much for the, leading this discussion, Daniel. And thank you to everyone who joined us tonight. Thank you to our panelists this evening for your wonderful words. And thank you to our audience. The book is Dear McSweeney's, but we hope everyone has a wonderful night and joins us for a program again soon. Thank you to everyone.
Thank you so much, Allison. Thanks to Seminary Co-op and American Writers Museum. Thanks to our panelists.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, to celebrate Hispanic American Heritage Month, we chat with Juan Martinez, author of the short story collection Best Worst American. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.